Well, here we are once again getting hit with another week of extreme cold. And if the ice and cold is tough enough for you, it's no surprise that it can be rough for our trees and shrubs as well. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Really pleased to have with us Sharon Morrissey, UW Extension Consumer Horticulture Agent for Milwaukee County. Thank you for joining us today, Sharon.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Oh, it's always so much fun to have you with us. You know, it's kind of funny. I went outside this morning to walk to the radio station. I thought, oh, it's not too bad out, you know. And I thought, wait a minute. It's like zero. And I'm saying, oh, it's a hot spell.
I know. You know, I had a similar experience this morning. I went out and I thought, this isn't too bad. It's almost starting to give a hint of spring. Can't be. It's 5 degrees. But we acclimate very well to this, don't we?
Yeah, probably our plants do not do as well. You know, you may have some recommendation, I hope, for de-icing products that are plant friendly and that work at low temperatures. Certainly dealing with a lot of ice and snow and low temps.
Yeah, and the problem is these low temperatures. But there are a few products that do work at low temperatures that are also pretty friendly to plants. One of them is calcium chloride. It probably works at the lowest temperatures. It's a lot more expensive than rock salt, but you only use about a third as much. So, you know, if you're careful with how much you apply, it's certainly not exorbitantly priced. But it is better for our plants than sodium chloride, which can be hard on them. There's also magnesium chloride. And calcium magnesium acetate, that's another one of the ones that's less toxic to plants. So those are things to look for. But also keeping in mind, if the temperature range for that product is not as low as the temperatures we're having, putting it down is not going to help anything.
Yep.
So wait until those temperatures rise a little bit for some of those products.
Yeah, otherwise you're just kind of throwing your money away.
Yeah.
Among other things. there's also a concern about the damage the ice and the extreme cold might be causing to our trees and shrubs. Mm-hmm. And what should we really be watching for?
Well, there are, you know, plants have their limits. They can't just put on a coat to keep warmer when the temperatures get colder. And most plants do have kind of a built-in minimum temperature that they can tolerate, and then they just die. And our species, the plants that fall into the prunus species, which is all the apricots, cherries, plums, peaches, ornamental as well as production, those are very sensitive to cold temperatures. Even if the tree itself isn't sensitive to cold temperatures, the flower buds may very readily be killed by these cold temperatures. And, you know, in general, for plants, it's that fluctuation of temperature which is really the hardest on them. Now, we haven't had a lot of that, unless you're considering 22 down to minus 8 being a big fluctuation. But once we're down in those ranges, I don't think it matters that much. It's, you know, when we drop from, you know, 40 degrees to 20 degrees in a matter of a half a day or something, that's really hard on trees and shrubs. So I think we'll see probably some tip dieback. You may have some flower bud death, and therefore your forsythias may survive, but the flowers that are above the snow level might not flower.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you have anything in the prunus genus, the flowering plums and flowering almonds, they may not have flowers this spring. So we'll have some damage, but we're very lucky we had the snow. That really is going to help.
That helped a lot. Is there anything we can do to protect plants at this point? I mean, anything additional?
Yeah, really not much we can do at this point. With the snow cover on there, that's a good insulator. You know, if you've got an area that didn't get a lot of snow, at this point we've had enough cold temperatures that even putting some pine boughs or straw or something, it's kind of too late for all of that.
Yep. Sharon Morrissey, our guest, UW Extension Consumer Horticulture Agent for Milwaukee County. Wonderful to have her with us. She comes by every so often to talk with us on Garden Talk. And it's great to have you listening in. If you have a question for her, I hope you will join us. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or certainly post on my Facebook page. at the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. You can post a question, comment, or even a photo there. And we'll see what we can do about identifying the problems that you may have. Maybe you're concerned about damage to trees and shrubs. What about tools? That's something we haven't talked about much.
Yeah.
And, you know, we did I actually, you know, and I don't always do this, Sharon, but I actually took care of my tools this fall, cleaned them up, and so they're ready for spring. But I got to tell you, I don't normally that doesn't happen, or often yeah. It doesn't happen.
There are those of us who don't get around to it every couple of years, maybe. But it does really help to have clean, sharpened tools. You know, people don't think about that all that much. It's, you know, it works in the dirt. It, you know, why yep. do you have to clean up your tools? But there is that matter of corrosion. Tools will last longer if they aren't corroding, and having that constant contact with the soil and rust will certainly corrode the tool. So, you know, scraping that off with emery cloth or with a steel wool is a good way to start the process. Then you can coat the metal working part of the shovel or hoe or rake with some oil, mm-hmm. and then the handles too. You don't think about the fact that those handles can get kind of rough. Mm-hmm. They're harder on your hands. It's harder to use them when they're uncomfortable. So using some linseed oil on the handle will help. If it's a wooden handle, will really help to solidify that, make it smoother and easier to use. And then, of course, sharpening the blades. Shovels need to be sharpened. Hoes need to be sharpened. You know, we always think of saws and pruning shears that need to be sharpened, and that's true, too. But even those larger tools, using a grinding wheel on a metal shovel or a hoe, and getting a good sharp angle and edge on that. You can also just use a hand flat file to file it. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, might be something you want to do when there's really absolutely nothing you can be doing outside.
And I tell you what, there's
the garden, at least.
There's nothing like a good sharp hole blade.
Yeah.
I'm telling you, it makes the work so much easier, and that's one thing I've been pretty good at.
I think a lot of people think a hoe is meant to be pounded into the soil and pulled back with a lot of soil coming with it. But hoes really are, there are many different ways to use a hoe, but one of them is to just cut the weed off right at the soil surface,
mm-hmm.
and not dig into the soil. And by not digging into the soil, you're not disturbing weed seeds that are already down in the soil that wouldn't have germinated if you didn't bother them.
Yep.
So a sharp hoe can really be making weeding and care for your garden easier for that reason.
Well, we have Heidi in Madison who has a question for you. Let's go to her. Hi, Heidi. Thank you for calling.
Thanks for having me. I have a pussy willow bush that we planted last year, and it made it through the drought, and I'm kind of new to stuff like this, so we thought that we shouldn't crush it with snow when we were shoveling because it's by our driveway.
Mm-hmm.
But the rabbits came and ate most of it. So we buried the rest in snow so they couldn't get at it. And I was just wondering, for next year, we will probably cover it in snow, I think. But any way to keep the rabbits away from them?
Yeah, fencing. You know, rabbits are very determined, and they will stand on the snow and get branches that are higher up if there is snow. And if there isn't snow, they'll eat lower down.
So they stood on the little snow pile and ate all the branches.
But the good news is that pussy willows are very, very vigorous.
Yeah.
And so it will come back in the spring. You know, you're kind of starting over again, but it will come back in the spring. You'll have new growth, and, you know, you may not be able to enjoy any of the flower buds that you were planting it for. But, you know, on the other hand, sometimes what happens is when there's bark gnawed off of a branch, there's still enough carbohydrate reserve in the branch that when spring comes, the leaf buds and the flower buds, and in the case of pussy willow, that's kind of what you're growing it for, those will open up. And then that'll be the end of it.
So I have another question about pussy willows.
All right.
How do you, like, how do you prune them in the fall? Do you prune them in the fall or in the spring? Like,
yeah.
How do you the best, prune them?
Well, the best time of year for most of our woody trees and shrubs is the end of the dormant season. That's the best for the plant. Things that you're pruning that produce their flower buds in the previous summer and flower in the spring, you wait till they're done flowering. So with the pussy willow, you would wait until it's done flowering, and then you would prune. And then it's a matter of looking for those branches that are conflicting with each other, you know, rubbing against each other, dead or diseased branches get cut out, and then some shaping. If you're growing it into a tree form or a bush form, you have that option with pussy willow. That's the time you can kind of start to decide that. And I think what I might do with those pussy willow branches is to cut a few of them, you know, pretty much any time now probably, and bring them indoors and put them in some water. And you can easily force those into bloom indoors.
Ooh.
And that way your rabbits won't have totally ruined your enjoyment of your pussy willow for this year.
They ruined that one pretty good, but what's left of it is under the snow, so they can't get at it anymore.
Okay.
Well, then the mice can get at it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, those little critters, they have to make a living, too.
Yeah.
And they'll eat bark when there's nothing else to eat.
Heidi, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. If you have a question or comment, love to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@WPR.org or post on my Facebook page. Love that. And post some garden photos would be great, too. That'd be kind of nice to look at some nice summer garden photos, I think. I'm Larry Mueller. Cheryl Gasser, our on-air producer, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. So happy to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you with us as we talk with Sharon Morrissey, UW Extension Consumer Horticulture Agent for Milwaukee County on this edition of Garden Talk. You can reach us with your questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234. And we hope you'll give us a call. And matter of fact, Stephen has done that. So let's go to Stephen. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. We live in Milwaukee, and we planted a Concord grape that we didn't know was going to like the spot. I don't know, fortunately or unfortunately, it really liked it. So it really grew and outgrew the trellis that it was on. And I don't want to damage the grape, but I need to cut it back quite a bit so that I can build a proper support for it.
Yeah.
How do I do that without killing it?
Well, the good news is with grapes, you generally need to cut back almost the entire plant. I mean, not to the ground, but most of the canes that are produced each year get cut all the way back to a main structure, and then the new canes that grow this year are the ones that will produce the fruit. So you're doing the right thing by really cutting it back quite severely. Now, there are several different pruning styles or methods and systems that you develop the structure for. I think the easiest one is probably to have a main trunk and then what they call two arms. So you have one main cane that you maintain year after year after year going in each direction along the support. But supports do have to be really sturdy because grapes do produce pounds and pounds worth of wood in these canes every year. So that's what you've learned now, and you're going to rectify that problem. So I would really recommend that you get a copy of or go online and look at our publication on growing grapes in Wisconsin.
It's a really good one.
Oh, it's excellent.
Yeah.
And, you know, they say a picture's worth a thousand words. It's definitely true with grape pruning because it is a little bit detailed. Once you understand it, it makes sense, and you can do it. But you are going to be able to be successful with it without killing off this grape. I think you'll definitely be able to be successful.
Mm-hmm.
What you're looking for is the single cordon type of pruning. That's the name for this type I'm describing. And that's on our Learning Store website, learningstore.uwex.edu, and then go under Lawn and Garden, and then go to Fruits, and I'm not sure if it's under, I guess it'd be under small fruits.
I think it's under small fruits.
Yeah.
I've been to that many a time.
And it's an excellent publication. Yep. And it'll tell you about some other cultivars and all kinds of insect and disease problems to watch for and how to deal with those. And, yeah, great publication.
Yeah. I recommended that publication to somebody who described himself as not at all a gardener. And he came back and said, boy, that is a good publication.
Yeah. Yeah. All of our fruit publications really are wonderful. They've got great illustrations because, you know, fruit crops aren't quite as straightforward as, you know, carrots and radishes and
right.
cucumbers and things. They often have some kind of training or development of the structure of the plant that's involved. And so it's good to know those nuances to be successful.
Yeah. Stephen, thank you. Appreciate the call. Jan in Monticello, your turn. Hi.
Good morning. I have a question about a bay plant. I've had it about 4 to 5 years. It's 4 feet tall or more, and I put it out in the summer, bring it in the spring, in the winter, mm-hmm. and I repotted it this fall, gave it new soil, trimmed the roots, and it did fantastic. Well, now I'm noticing it has, like, around the outer edges of the leaf, some of them are turning brown, and there's holes in the leaf, not all of them, but mm-hmm. I don't see any insects on it. Mm. I don't know if, could I be watering it too much? Could it have a fungus?
Well, I guess the answer is it's a possibility. Both of those things are a possibility. If you're not seeing any insects, it probably isn't an insect. And the fact that you just repotted it, I'm presuming you gave it all new soil at the time, and a clean pot, I would hope. It's probably not from soluble salts, which build up in soil over time in houseplants. So that would have been my first guess on this and my first recommendation, but you've already done that. So then we have to start looking at what else could be doing it. When it's around the margins like that, salts definitely burn the margins, the edges of the leaves, but we're kind of ruling that out unless the damage had really kind of started before you repotted it and it's just a continuation. You can have fungus and other diseases that can cause that. And you said they were spots in the leaves or holes in the leaves?
There's holes in the leaves. They start out as a spot and then...
Oh, okay. And then like the center falls out.
Yeah.
That tissue in the middle falls out and then it's a hole. So it starts out as a spot. And that does sound like it could be from a fungus or some other organism that's causing a disease. Because I'm not real familiar with bay, and also with all house plants, there are lots of different organisms that can cause problems, and usually it's when the plant's under stress that they become more susceptible to these things. I guess I would recommend that you send a few leaves of it into our plant disease diagnostic clinic, and they can tell you if it's a disease that's causing the problem. If so, what fungicide might rectify the problem. Other than that, you know, watering is really important to make sure that the water is draining through the pot and that it's washing away those soluble salts. Repotting it, as I said, took care of part of that. I guess another possibility would be overwatering. If you're keeping the soil real wet, if you're allowing the pot to sit in the water that drains through it and soak it back up, that accumulates soluble salts, but it also keeps the soil wet for longer. So, you know, I guess that could be the problem. But if it's 4 feet tall already, you've had it for 4 or 5 years, it sounds like you've been, caring for it properly for that long. So that's why I'd kind of want to know if there's something else going on there.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
Thank you.
They're pretty hardy, I would think. So...
Yeah.
You know, I don't really know. I don't know how easy it is to get a plant to that size. I know I had one that was about 8 inches tall and stayed that way for about 3 years. So I'm really impressed with your 4 foot bay plant.
Yeah.
You've been doing something right.
Thank you, Jan.
Thank you.
Appreciate the call. Yeah, that's pretty good, 4 feet.
Yeah, yeah.
Judy in Lodi, it is your turn. Hi, Judy. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry and your guest. I have, in our family, we've been doing this now for 4 years, growing catalpa trees.
And oh, uh-huh.
My grandson dug into the snow for Christmas to find me a long pod. And he gave me a bowl of dirt and some growing materials, and because that's how my daughter-in-law started it, in a bowl.
Uh-huh.
Because they grow a foot a year.
And yeah, they can be pretty fast growing at first.
Yeah, and where I live, it's an apartment building, but the owner gave me permission to plant it.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just wondering when I should start with those seeds, because they're really funny looking. They look like feathers.
Yes, they
like
do.
The normal,
they do.
Not like the normal Wisconsin catalpa, where those are round pods. This is like a bean. It's from Illinois, and we've been growing, like I said, for four generations.
Yeah. But the seeds themselves on the inside are a real flat seed, and then they've got kind of going out either side off the seed are kind of papery, feathery that stuff.
That when you open it up, it flies all over, Yeah.
So, you know, I'm not real sure about when you would start them indoors. I don't think it really matters so much. Once you get it going, you probably have to provide it with pretty much light. So kind of the longer you wait, the better, because light levels are pretty low indoors right now, unless you have some grow lights that you're going to, or some, you know, supplemental lights.
My problem is I have a aloe vera plant that weighs 180 pounds, which takes the whole table in my room where the sun is.
I would guess. Well, then I would wait until you can get some good light for it. So maybe not even starting it until you can start it outdoors. Now, the fact that it is a plant that grows in this area, I would think that the seeds would germinate as soon as the soil starts to warm up in the spring for a timing reference, you know, if you want to start it in a container. So probably sometime in, you know, March or something, you could probably start it. Maybe mid-April start it if you're going to do it outdoors where it can get more light. But then be prepared if that little seedling starts to emerge and it gets cold again, you're going to have to cover it for a little bit and then uncover it again to get it going. But good luck with that. The thing with catalpa is that they are are very prone to diseases. Verticillium wilt is the main thing that they get, and that's why we don't have a lot of really big catalpas around town. We do have some, but you'll see a lot that have died back and then they sprout from the stump, and those will grow to about, you know, 15 feet tall, and then all of a sudden it'll all die down, and it's because of this disease. But it'd be fun to get started and plant it in the yard and grow it for as long as you can.
Judy, thank you so much. Appreciate your call. And you can join in, too. Do you have a garden question, maybe about your trees or your shrubs, or maybe it's about flowers? It could be even vegetables. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We have Alex from Grafton emailed us. Says, I love to bring flowering plants into my home over winter because Christmas cactuses and besides Christmas cactuses and violets, what are some flowering plants that would do well indoors this winter?
Well, anything that you purchase now that is in flower, stay in flower for a while and you'd be able to enjoy it for a while. A lot of the flowering plants we can grow indoors do require pretty high light. The lowest light of the house plants that actually does flower is the peace lily. It and the Chinese evergreen both will produce their flowers, which are that spade and spadix type flower, sort of like Jack in the Pulpit sort of. So they're real pretty, but they're not hugely floriferous. Gloxinias are kind of an old-fashioned flowering plant you can grow indoors. It's related to the African violet, has kind of fuzzy leaves, but it does require kind of high light. Azaleas. Azaleas like cool temperatures, and so that makes it nice because mm-hmm. many of us keep our houses, you know, in the 60s or whatever throughout the winter, and they can tolerate that quite nicely. Others, amaryllis, you know, the kind of a more people grow that more for Christmas, but it certainly could be started now, and you could grow amaryllis flowers indoors.
Boy, you got a lot of them there.
Some of the other ones, calancho or calanchoe, as some people call them, or nice cineraria is another one that you can get from a florist to, or a good greenhouse, you know, that has a wide selection. Orchids are spectacular for flowering indoors, even if you never reflower them. The prices that they sell orchids for these days, an orchid in flower will stay in flower for 3 months or more. You know, even if you don't have the right conditions to get it to flower again, you certainly have gotten your money's worth out of it just, you know, in this period of time. So there are a few ideas for you.
Yeah, some great ones, actually. Don in Whitewater has a question about vegetables, I believe. Don, hello.
Hello, how are you doing today?
Great, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
I planted some asparagus in my yard a couple of years ago and fertilized with the stuff the seed company sent me, and the raccoons liked it so much that they dug it up and left the plants laying there to die. The reason I fertilized was I bought two-year-old plants thinking that they'd take off, but they never actually did. After 2 years, I just aborted the whole mission, and I was told that the reason they didn't take off was because I got some kind of nut tree in my yard and some kind of tannins or something gets into the soil. And
black walnut, probably.
Yeah, black walnut, and it's not good for asparagus.
Yeah, probably.
What I wanted to know was if, I got two horseshoe sets that have been there for a long time, and that's where I put the asparagus originally. If I put heavy plastic down, you know, dug them down a ways, got rid of all the dirt, put heavy plastic, something impermeable down on the bottom, and then put new soil in on top and fertilize it, would that work?
Well, what happens with the roots of the plant you're trying to grow and the black walnut roots is when they come in contact is when you have the problem. The black walnut roots produce a substance called juglone, and that substance is toxic, but the roots have to come in pretty close contact to each other. Now, even a layer of plastic isn't going to be impermeable forever, and the vigor of asparagus roots, I would think that they would grow through that. They do need to start out pretty deep. I don't know how deep they go after that. They more spread out than down. So, you know, I don't think you have to worry about really deep rooting, but I still think that they would grow through this plastic over time, and then, you know, they would die off again. I just don't think there's much of a way to do it. Now, a raised bed.
Whoops.
I'm sorry.
Don, what were you saying?
I was thinking about the kind of plastic that's like quarter inch thick. Root, you're telling me a root's going to grow through quarter inch of plastic?
Well,
if it's sheet plastic, it's going to go through it.
Yeah, I think so. No. But anyway, another option would be raised beds.
Yeah.
And I have seen people grow asparagus in raised beds. And you could do a bed that, in fact, I have a bed of asparagus that is, let me think, it's probably, I think these beds are 6 feet long, 6 to 8 feet long and probably 3 feet wide. And I have one row of asparagus in there, and it does spectacularly. I would want to raise that, the height of that, so it's at least 6 or 8 inches deep, and then I would start at that level, but don't dig down into the existing soil. So, and if you can go, you know, 10 inches deep, 12 inches deep, all the better.
All the better.
That would certainly, I think that would really mitigate the problem with the black walnut.
What do you use for a floor in this raised bed?
I don't think you need to worry about that. You could put plastic down, but that's just a matter of having some weed control. But I don't think it's going to stop if you start at the level of the soil so that, you know, and a little bit above that with the asparagus and then provide the remainder of the raised bed for it to grow in, I don't think it's going to go down deep enough to get to the roots of the black walnut. So I don't think you have to worry about putting anything down before you put the raised bed in.
Now, you often see that as a recommendation, and I don't know. You know, you see recommendations even from various extension services, and I've looked. I really want to know what the best way to do a raised bed is. And, you know, sometimes they'll recommend putting down plastic. Sometimes they'll recommend, oh, you can put down cardboard, or you can put down a landscape fabric, a weed barrier. And then other times they say just put it directly on the soil. If you have decent soil, work that soil up a little bit before you put the new soil on top, so that you don't have this barrier between one type of soil and another type of soil. But I really don't think, my opinion is that it's really not necessary to put something down under a raised bed before you put it down. Unless you've got soil you don't want plants growing into, then you have to put some kind of barrier that's not going to be penetrated by the roots.
Landscape fabric could work. I mean, if you were...
Yeah, but I've seen stuff grow through landscape. I guess a real heavy-duty landscape fabric, a plastic landscape fabric.
you're right about that. But as Don, I hope you. I wish you well, and I wish you good luck. But I think Sharon's got the right advice here with a raised bed.
A raised bed, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And thank you very much for calling. I appreciate your call. Dana in River Hills says, my new neighbors use salt on their sidewalk, and it flows downhill to my yard as things melt. I'm not seeing any damage to my lawn, but should I be worried? What should I watch for? I guess my first question would be, is it really salt, or could it be one of the other products that you were talking about?
Yeah, exactly. Finding that out would be helpful. And there is a publication. I don't know how you would feel about maybe sharing that publication with them that talks about plant damage from de-icing products. And, you know, there's two ways that these de-icing products cause damage. In this situation, it's the runoff and then melting down into the soil. And then the roots of the plants take that up, and then you have salt damage on the plants. The other type of damage is the salt spray from traffic that moves quickly across roadways and kicks up a spray, which you're not having in your own yard. But the damage that you would see would be in the spring, you know, later in the spring, actually, after the plant starts to grow again as it's absorbing the salt, you'd see browning around the margins of the leaves. That is typical salt damage. To avoid that, if you really think that you have had a good dose of salt into the soil where the plants are growing, is to water it really well and leach that soil through the root zone and down beyond where the roots are growing.
Yeah.
So, and you know, the good news is that if we have a lot of snow, then the snow, as long as it's not snow that's mixed with salt, it will melt down, and it provides the leaching for us. It's those winters where we don't have a lot of snow, but we do have ice, and people use a lot of salt or de-icing products that then melts into the soil, and we don't have the snow melt to leach it through. So you can leach it through by watering it yourself.
Rod in Weyerhaeuser has a question. Hi, Rod. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. Yeah, I have just a question. I stuck some asparagus in, and I was waiting. I just put the whole pot worth in, and I didn't trench and all that stuff. And I said, well, if they grow, they grow. You know. Well, anyhow, I've heard from different people. They say that around asparagus, you're supposed to put salt. You know, and I'm just wondering if that's true, and if it is, how much, and do you use iodized or regular salt?
That's an old story, isn't it, Sharon?
That is. That's kind of it's an old wives' tale in a way.
Yeah.
It was what people used to use to control weeds in an asparagus bed. It had nothing to do really with making the asparagus grow better. It was a way to control weeds. So it is not recommended. Salt is not good for asparagus plants. So you don't have to worry about how much and what kind. Don't use it.
Don't use it. No.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And you may want to put a little additional soil over the crowns this spring as they start to come up.
Yeah.
And that's about all you need to do in the spring. Weeding and keeping the weeds out of an asparagus bed is one of the more important things that you do for your asparagus. So if you can keep the weeds under control by hand, that's the best way to do it.
Yep. There you go.
Hey, thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Rod. for Colin.
I love asparagus. I just love asparagus. I can't wait. We had a great crop in our garden last year that I do with some master gardeners, and I'm really looking forward to it again this year.
I just think back, and I've probably mentioned this one other time. My dad and I, at his home and at my home, we planted asparagus the same year. I did everything by the book, trenched it and all this, and my dad just dug a hole and stuck them in. And, of course, his grew like crazy, and mine never came up.
Yeah, those plants, they just don't read the book sometimes. You must have got the illiterate plants.
I guess I did. I don't know. Greg called and wondered how long does it take herbicides like Roundup to break down. I want to plant after treating an area in my yard, but I'm worried that nothing will grow. Really doesn't take a long time.
Yeah, Roundup's not a problem because it's not absorbed by the soil itself. It's absorbed through the plants, and then it's metabolized by the plants. And so you can plant into an area that you've put Roundup on pretty much right away.
Yeah.
The idea, though, is to wait until the plants have died, which takes about 14 days, and then you can plant into it. And things will grow. That is not a problem. That's one of the reasons why Roundup is so popular and used so extensively, is that it is this nice, fast, thorough weed control that doesn't stay in the soil and is only taken up by green leafy plant material.
Damn.
And it's moved down into the roots, and then the plants die within about 2 weeks. And then you can carry on.
Sharon Morrissey, our guest today, UW Extension Consumer Horticulture Agent for Milwaukee County. Hope you'll join in with your questions or comments. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234, email us at talk@wpr.org, or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'd certainly love to hear from you. I'm Larry Mueller on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, visiting today with Sharon Morrissey, UW Extension Consumer Horticulture Agent for Milwaukee County. Great to have her along. Thank you so much for listening in. If you have a question for her, I hope you'll phone in at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org. or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We had a lot of posts on my Facebook page. I'm just looking at them right now, as a matter of fact. And someone wondered about Sharon, about the juglon toxicity. Do the roots have to come in contact? I thought this person is saying juglon was exuded into the soil and causes a toxicity through the soil. So is the toxicity really just root to root?
Well, that's what our publication says, is that it is root to root. They need to come in contact. But it is a substance that's exuded by the roots. So I don't know how close it actually has to be physical contact, but that is what our publication states. So that is what I go by.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they're pretty shallow. You know, you think about tree roots. Most people think of tree roots as growing down and being quite deep, and yet we know that we run into them with our lawnmowers a lot of times when we're
sure.
We have a large old tree in the yard. But when you think about like a windfall, a tree that's been blown over and the whole root system pops up out of the ground, well, that's the root system. It's not that it broke off and that's all that came up. It's that is the majority of the root system, and it's just kind of a flat pan of roots. And they expand way out beyond the drip line of the tree. So those roots can be quite shallow, and really just about anything that you plant into the soil near a black walnut tree. And I think they say within 60 feet of the tree, if it comes, it will come in contact with some of the roots, and they will be exposed to the juglon.
Another question on this from someone, do the drop leaves and nuts contain juglon? If so, where they decompose, will that contain juglon?
Yeah, they do say to keep the nuts, the husks from the nuts, and the leaves out of compost piles for that reason. And I don't know how long it takes for it to break down, but I know with our master composter training, it does say to avoid black walnut leaves and the husks. And I think it's because they also contain the juglon, and so it can be damaging to plants.
Mm-hmm. Mike in Fort Atkinson has a question, so let's go to Mike. Hi, thanks for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. I have a question about my tulips. They come up every year. Sometimes some plants come up and they get these big, broad leaves that just kind of flop over and it doesn't ever flower or anything. And, you know, tulips right close to them will come up normally and, you know, the leaves will stand up and then they'll flower and stuff. And wonder why sometimes some of them don't act like they're supposed to.
Yeah. Well, part of it may be the fact that as they multiply, and tulips don't multiply a lot, but they do produce small bulbils off the base of the bulb every year, and those over the years do continue to get larger and larger and larger, and they have to get to a certain size before they'll actually produce a flower. And so some of these kind of blind leaves you're seeing that are leaves without a flower may be from these small bulbils that are starting to grow and have grown for several years, but, you know, made small leaves each year and now they're making a larger leaf. It could also be that, you know, the thing that develops the flower within the bulb every year is after flowering is over, the new flower bud forms as that bulb ripens. And so it has to have leaves to ripen. It has to have good growing conditions, meaning it has to have light. And that's what starts to diminish, especially if the bulbs are planted underneath a deciduous tree. And it may not be getting enough light to actually form a flower bud inside. It could also be damaged by rodents or something. But I really think it's more a case of the young bulbs growing and having not matured yet enough to make a flower bud. But the fact that you're getting some flowers means that you probably do have enough light and pretty good growing conditions and that you are letting the leaves ripen before you cut them down or remove them. So
there's really nothing I can do about it or nothing you know I have to worry about. It's just a matter of letting them flop over for a year or so and then the next year they'll be fine, hopefully.
Hopefully. Fertilizing is important for bulbs, too, and the best time to fertilize is right after they've finished flowering. So for that planting, when that type of tulip has finished flowering, it'd be a good idea to apply some balanced fertilizer. And it's the nitrogen that they need the most. It's not phosphorus or potassium that they need as much as they do nitrogen. But they don't need, you know, high quantities. Put too much nitrogen, you're not going to have any flowers either. But they do need a nitrogen. So you might want to try, if you haven't been fertilizing, it might be a good idea to try that this year after they're done flowering.
Mm-hmm.
That may help get some flowering going for next year.
Thanks, Mike.
All right. Thank you.
Appreciate the call. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call as we visit with Sharon Morrissey, UW Extension Consumer Horticulture Agent for Milwaukee County. Some nice Facebook comments and questions. A nice photo. Phil King sent a photo in of a neighborhood of serious gardeners. And boy, you look, it's kind of an aerial view of a neighborhood. And I think just every single house has a garden in the backyard, and it looks pretty cool. And it's all nice and green, and it looks it looks so nice. Oh,
that will come again.
It'll come
again. I have faith. That will come again.
Chris was wondering about pruning apple trees. Lives in Superior, has a Whitney crab. When is the best time to prune? We do want apples.
For their crab.
Yeah, I guess.
Okay. Yeah, well, best time to prune is end of the dormant season. You know, you're going to be pruning out some of the flower buds, but what you've left will be a better structure for the plant. And, you know, sometimes if apple trees can overproduce and then each of the apples would be smaller. And this is a crab apple, so, you know, you're trying to encourage good flowering. But yeah, the structure of the tree is really important. Good light penetration is important. So end of the dormant season is the best time to prune a crab apple. And that would be like end of March, early April.
Okay. Lorna in Elgin has a question. Hi, Lorna.
You.
Hi. Hello? Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
I'm just wondering what I have a couple of oak trees, very old oak trees, and I'm wondering why they hold on to their leaves all through the winter. They never really drop them.
Yeah.
And it's like three quarters up. The tree is filled with leaves. They're brown, but they never fall off.
And yeah, oaks do that. They do it more than about anything else I can think of. And they're
are kind of two reasons for this. Part of it is that oak trees evolved from being a southern species, being from a warm climate. They've been around for millennia, but they started out in warm climates and kind of adapted to colder climates as they moved north. And one of the things that never really adapted as well as the rest of their tolerance was leaf drop. Because in the warmer climates, they're evergreen. But they just don't form a good layer that allows that leaf to cut off and fall off. And so they just stay on all year round, you know, all winter long. And then the new buds open up, and as they come off, they, you know, the new leaves come out, then these old leaves fall off. Another reason that this happens in some species, and the reason you're seeing it in the lower part of the tree, is what's called juvenility. And it's kind of the opposite of what you think. You think, well, that's the oldest part of the tree, so why would it be a juvenile kind of trait? Well,
yeah.
It's because that's the part of the tree that was the youngest. It was the first thing that was developed. And when it developed, it had this characteristic of not being able to drop its leaves very well. And so even though the branches up at the top are newer branches, they're formed from older wood. So they
got it.
You see what I mean?
So it doesn't mean that the oak tree is dying. It just is a natural process.
Yep.
No, it's kind of a neat thing. I love when I see an oak that has a lot of leaves on it still in the wintertime, because I just think it's so pretty, and it's because it has to do with evolution and all that. I just think it's kind of a neat thing.
And I like it. I like the sound. I like the sound when the wind comes through those trees and those leaves crackle.
Yeah,
today is really doing that. All right. Well, thank you very much.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Thanks a lot for calling. John in Richland Center. Hello.
Hello. Hold on. Let me turn my radio off. The only oak tree that keeps its leaves is the white oak, because I've got hundreds of them. I've got hundreds of red oaks, too, but the red oaks are... they all lose their leaves, but the white oaks hang out of their leaves, and I don't know why.
Yeah. Well, other oaks will do it, too. It kind of, you know, they're individuals. If they've come from an acorn, they're an individual. If they've come from a nut, so some have the ability to lose their leaves better than others. And so there are red oaks that will hold their leaves. There are black oaks that will. White oaks will. You're right. Swamp white oaks will. I think most of the oaks that we have in northern climates will, to some extent, hold their leaves. And then other individuals will lose them all.
Yeah, there you go. Thanks, John. Appreciate it. Hubern in Mequon. Hi, thanks for calling.
Good morning. I have a plum tree that produced a lot of plums over the years, but it developed some kind of a cancerous growth.
Mm-hmm.
And I was advised to cut them off, and I did. But mm-hmm. the more I cut them, the more cancerous growth it developed.
Wow.
Yeah.
So I cut down the tree totally and replanted a new plum about 200 feet away.
Mm-hmm.
And the second year it produced fruits, but the same stuff happened with the growth again. So I don't know if I used some contaminated shears.
No. No, it's an airborne fungus. There's a couple of different things that'll do that. One of them's called black knot. And it looks sort of like a black cigar-like structure that forms on the branches. Is that what you're seeing?
Exactly.
Okay. So that is black knot, and it's very common. Some cultivars and varieties of the prunus, all of the stone fruits, will do that, some to a greater extent than others. And I'm just real quickly, I have our spray schedule here, and I know it talks about black knot. By April 1, you prune out the infested branches, burn or remove them. Spraying alone will not control the disease, but you do have to prune out what's there. And even if you prune it out, if the tree is susceptible, it can easily get it again and again and again.
Hmm.
But it doesn't have anything to do with having the leaves around or having contaminated soil or anything like that. It's the varieties you're selecting. Do you know what variety your plum tree is?
I think it was, what is it now? European plum.
a European plum.
Right.
Yeah, there's a great variety of European plum. Doesn't seem to be as susceptible to black knot that I'm growing. It's Mount Royal, spectacular plums. It is the European plum. So you might want to just try a different variety. Again, our fruit publications are excellent through the Learning Store website for UW Extension, and there is one on apricots, cherries, peaches, and plums. And there's also a publication on selecting varieties of fruit for southern Wisconsin and another one for northern Wisconsin. So I would recommend you look at that publication and maybe select a different variety and try that and see if you have better luck.
Mm-hmm. And the publication again is?
The name of the publication?
The publication is Growing Apricots, Cherries, Peaches, and Plums in Wisconsin.
There you go.
Number A3639. And you can get that on our Learning Store website, which is learningstore, all one word, .uwex.edu.
Thank you very much.
And it is a fabulous resource, isn't it? I'm telling you, it's love the work. I love the publications and love, of course, all the work that our Extension folks do. They do a wonderful job. Including, of course, Sharon Morrissey. Sharon is the University of Wisconsin Extension Consumer Horticulture Agent for Milwaukee County. She's been in Milwaukee County for a long time, and she does a wonderful job, and it's always great to have her on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Gardening can be a lot of fun and a relaxing activity. That doesn't mean that we don't need to put some time and effort into it to get some good results. And even then, sometimes things just don't thrive the way we'd like them to. But figuring out what might have gone wrong this year can help you have a much more successful season next time around. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network. And my guest, Sharon Morrissey, is here to help. She's the UW Extension Consumer Horticulture Agent for Milwaukee County. Knows a lot about successfully growing vegetables, flowers, fruits, and a whole lot more. And Sharon, thanks again for spending time with us today.
Well, you're welcome. Thank you, Larry, for having me.
We had a lot of callers online at 1-800-642-1234. You can also post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show or email us at talk@wpr.org. We had a nice comment from Linda on Facebook, who said, I heard about making tea from fresh thyme with lemon and honey to ease cold symptoms. So I went out to the garden, dug under the snow, and found my thyme plant. I picked a few sprigs, recovered the plant with snow, and made the tea. It was wonderful. I found the thyme plant is perfectly insulated and usable in the winter.
Well, that's amazing.
I love that.
That really shocks me, because usually with most of our herb plants, their oils just aren't being produced in the winter when it's this cold, so you don't get the flavors. But it's good to know that that worked out well for her.
Yeah, absolutely. Kay in Brookfield is with us next, so let's go to her. Hi, Kay.
Hi there. Looking for a miracle cure.
Okay.
Had several trees to heaven, which I consider the trees from hell.
Yeah.
They, with all the seeds they put out, we have tried to control it in the grass. I did talk to a horticulturalist who said, laughed and said, the tree will probably survive a nuclear bomb.
Yeah.
I agree with. Her suggestion is mole spray within 20 minutes. We have done this for the entire summer.
It's still there.
Oh, growing like crazy.
Well, what do we do then? You know, I think Sharon, and Kay's got a situation here where probably she just got a lot of seeds out there and they just keep coming up.
Well, yeah, a lot of seeds, but probably also those seeds have been able to develop to be, you know, kind of a thick stem. So it's not just seedling. It's not just a one-year-old seedling, because those should be able to be killed pretty readily with a herbicide. If you're mowing it and mowing it and mowing it, it's still growing, it's still developing a root system, it's still thickening, and you probably have big woody lumps all over in the lawn. That happens a lot of times when plants form suckers from their roots in a lawn. And Tree of Heaven can do that. Poplars are real commonly do that. Sumacs do that a lot. And then you just have to kind of cut them out. Dig them out, cut them out as best you can, because using herbicides really doesn't control it. It's a difficult situation and one that you kind of have tried to prevent from getting that far.
Mm. Kay, thank you for calling. Appreciate your call, and good luck with the Tree of Heaven. Man, just have to keep after it, I guess, Sharon.
Yeah, yes.
Bill and Viroqua. I'm sorry, go ahead.
There's no easy way to do it, unfortunately.
Yeah. Bill in Viroqua, it's your turn. Hi, Bill.
Hello.
What's on your mind?
Hello. We've got a small apple orchard of about 25 or 30 apple trees, and I'd like to know how to make my apples larger when we go down to Gainesville to buy our apples, because our kids come and pick the small apples. They're about twice the size, or at least 40% larger. I was wondering how to make them.
Yeah, and it's really not too difficult, depending on how many apple trees you have. It's a matter of thinning and not allowing the tree to bear fully. So it produces its flowers, and on each spur that produces flowers on an apple tree, there'll be about five flowers. The very first one that forms is called the king blossom. It will produce the largest apple. All the other blossoms will produce apples, but the more apples you have, the smaller each apple is going to be. So you need to thin out some of those flowers. You can use your hand to go limb by limb and go from your thumb to your little finger is about 6 or 8 inches for most people, and that's the spacing that you want for apples. And then everything in between that, you know, start at one flower bud and go to the next one 8 inches further, and any other flower buds in between, just get rid of all the flowers. You can wait until the apples have started to form so that they're just little apples, and then it's easy to pluck those little apples off. Now, that's if you have a home apple tree in your backyard, or you have a couple apple trees and you have the time to do it by hand. There are chemicals that can be used to thin apples. They are sprayed at a very specific time so that not all the apples will be aborted, but some of them will. But that's how you get bigger apples, is to have fewer apples. So that thinning process is very important.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I kind of thought that, but I needed to know how much to take off and the process to do it. So,
yeah, we were really diligent about it at our garden this summer, and the volunteers and I, you know, stood there and used our little finger measuring and plucked off everything in between, and it made an enormous difference. We had big, beautiful apples on the trees this year.
Oh, great. Thanks again, Bill. That was a question that a lot of people probably wonder, why the heck don't I get bigger apples? And there's the reason. Barb in Oshkosh, you are next, and then we'll get to Janet. No, Creek, but Barb, you're next. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I'm just loving the show. It seems so good to listen to all this in this snowy, cold day.
Yeah, it sure does.
Well, my question concerns bush roses, which should be growing like weeds, they say. They're so easy to grow. Well, I keep trying to grow them. I've killed quite a few, actually. What happens to mine is the leaves get awful little holes, and I don't get as many flowers as I should. So I bought a systemic something that said to put around the rose bush, and it should help. And when I put that down, it gets better, but then it comes back all the time. And it's like I fight it the entire life of the bush all summer long.
Well, there are two things that will cause that I can think of right offhand that are very common, and it occurs on hybrid roses as well as the landscape shrub roses. One of them is called the rose slug sawfly, and the other one is Japanese beetles. And anything that compromises the amount of leaf tissue there is on the plant, you know, then you have less leaves to nourish the flowers and the rest of the plant. The rose slug sawfly causes the leaves to have sort of a little window painting in it. And you can actually see these things. I think the timing to look for them is like early June, if I remember properly. But as soon as you start to see that damage, if you look on the underside of the leaf and you look very carefully, you'll see a little worm that looks kind of shiny and green and looks kind of slimy almost. It looks like a little slug, and that's why they call this thing a rose slug sawfly. It's actually a sawfly larva. And the systemic should take care of that. There are two generations, though, and so again in August you may have the problem again. And then if it's Japanese beetle, the systemic should help take care of Japanese beetle, too. But again, it may not hold for an entire season. If you've only been doing this for a year where you tried the systemic control, keep it up and continue to try and control those two problems. Also, be sure that you use a good fertilizer program and that you're getting full sun to these plants and keeping them well watered but not overwatered by putting a mulch over the soil in the root zone to keep them moist. That's about all you should need to do to them.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, someone told me for fertilizing them, I should put all kinds of eggshells down. Is that correct?
They're not going to really provide very much nutrition.
Okay. No.
Eggshells are sometimes used to add a little calcium to the soil. Calcium isn't really a requirement for roses. They're not real sensitive to calcium deficiency. So the eggshells probably aren't doing much. Using either manure, a composted manure, or an organic fertilizer, or using a conventional synthetic fertilizer is important. Roses do benefit from a good fertilizer program.
Mm-hmm. Barb, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Janet in Oak Creek, your turn. Hi, Janet.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question about the Mount Royal plum that you were talking about earlier.
Mm-hmm.
I planted mine in 2008, and so far I've not had fruit, so I'm not sure, I guess, what to expect. Is that typical? And I don't remember the gallon size plant that I purchased it in, but it is in full sun. And then if you could also tell me about the fruit and what I'm missing. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, well, I can tell you about the fruit and what you're missing. They were the most spectacular plums I have ever had in my life. Oh, my gosh, and these things are blue and beautiful, and this was the first year we had any on this tree either. So this tree was planted in 2009.
Oh.
And when I got it, the tree I got, I think, was at least 2 years old because it had a branching structure. It wasn't just a stem, just a whip, they call them. It's an unbranched stem. So I got it after they had already taken that unbranched stem and pruned it and then allowed it to grow for another year. So mine could have been just a year older than yours. And ironically, I was just reading the Plum publication last night because I'm doing a brochure on fruits for your backyard, and it does say that it can take 3 to 5 years for some varieties of plums to produce. So we had beautiful flowers on ours each year, but finally this last year was the first time we had any plums.
There you go.
I think it's because of maturity.
Takes a while, Janet.
If the freeze doesn't kill your flower buds, you may have plums this year.
Oh, man. Good luck, Janet. Thanks a lot for calling. You can join in, too, by the way. If you have a question, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, and we will get you on real quick. I want to take a Facebook comment from Daniel, who says, I'm taking a 40-foot row of pine trees down. If I covered that area with 8 inches of topsoil, can I use it to plant vegetables?
Yeah, I don't see why not. It depends. Where is Daniel? Does he say where he is?
No, he doesn't say where he is.
Well, I'd do a soil test and see what that soil is like. 8 inches of soil over the top is going to be nice. Use good soil to do it.
But, you know, here in the southern and southeastern portion of the state, you're going to have very alkaline soil. And here under those pine trees, you would probably have a more acidic soil. And most plants like the soil more acidic than what we have here in southeastern Wisconsin. But I'd have a soil test run and get the pH. That'd be the main thing I'd be looking for. Other than that, I don't see any reason why not. Yeah. You know, you're going to run into stumps and roots and that sort of thing unless you're actually grinding out those stumps. But I think the soil should be fine for growing vegetables.
We have Harriet in Richland County emailed us. It says, I was plagued with mildew on my squash and cucumbers last year. Got no cukes. I use raised beds and worry about the mildew remaining in the soil. Do I have to worry? And if so, what do you do?
No, powdery mildew doesn't overwinter in the soil. It survives on plant material. So good sanitation, you know, removing the affected plants at the end of the season and getting them out of the garden, and then rotating your crops so that you're not planting anything in the vine family in the same place more than once every 3 to 4 years is another good way. Mm-hmm. But powdery mildew is in the air. It's insidious. It's everywhere. So mm-hmm. pretty much no matter where you plant them, you're going to have some powdery mildew. It has to do with the air circulation around the crops. The leaves need to dry off as quickly as possible. So if things are planted too thick, too close together, or if the stems are branches of the plants, the vines are laying on top of each other with lots of leaves, you'll have worse powdery mildew. But powdery mildew is just kind of a necessary evil with all of our vine crops, unfortunately. And there are fungicides that can be used, but you kind of have to keep up with it.
Yeah, that's the problem.
So, probably nothing you were doing wrong, except if you can get better air circulation into that area, that will help. Or, you know, thin out the foliage so you get better air circulation.
Mm-hmm.
And think about using a fungicide.
Jessica in Dodgeville, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have an indoor plant question. We have a jade plant. It's a couple of years old. It's the variegated type, and I put it in a pot and watered it and let it dry out and kind of continued doing that. But the pot is actually glazed, and so I think it retained water, and the hole at the bottom got clogged. So I think over time it got a little wet, which I know they don't like. So a couple weeks ago I repotted it. Well, it also started getting really droopy, and the leaves would fall onto the floor randomly. So we repotted it a couple of weeks ago into a clay pot with good drainage at the bottom, just with a regular garden soil mix or potting soil mix. But it just doesn't look very good, and I'm wondering what I should do next.
Well, my question would be what the roots looked like when you repotted it. Did you wash some of that soil off the roots so you could get a good look at the roots? Did they seem stout and sturdy and turgid, or did they seem kind of limp and slimy and rotting?
That's a good question. I didn't wash it off to check it out. I just put it in more soil, but it was quite soggy. One piece of the plant did break off, and it was one part that looked pretty bad, and it looked a little like not bright green inside. It was a little maybe moldy-ish looking.
Yeah, I bet it has been wet for quite some time and root rot has started. And the thing is with root rot is that that's caused by organisms that are in the soil, and so that soil ball that is around those roots has the organism in it. Once the tissue of the plant has started to break down, I don't think that you're going to be able to save that very well, even by drying it out. You know, that's allowing it to get good and dry is probably the best thing you can do. But the good news with jade plant is that it propagates very easily. You can propagate just even a leaf and stick the leaf into some soil, and it'll form roots. So you can take cuttings, stem cuttings or leaves, and root some more, so you have that, you know, insurance that you're going to have some plant. But then I would take this plant out of its pot. I would rinse off as much of the soil as you possibly can without totally destroying the roots, and then repotting it into some good, well-drained soil, and see
something entirely new.
Wet.
Entirely new soil?
Yes, I would use entirely new soil.
Yeah.
Okay. And
you may
want to
add
special.
A little bit of perlite to the soil. A lot of the potting soil mixes, I find, personally, I think they hold moisture a little bit too much. And so by adding some perlite, you're adding some drainage to the soil. You know, perlite's that white stuff that looks sort of like styrofoam, but it's actually lava rock.
Yep.
And that'll give
good
you
stuff.
Some drainage. Clay pot's probably not a bad idea when you've got, you know, soil that tends to stay too wet. And then also don't let the pot sit in the water that runs through the pot when you water. Prop it up on something so the water can drain into a saucer, but the plant's not soaking that water back up.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
Great.
Thank you much, Jessica. And Jake and Wilson, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hey, I have a Stanley plum. I planted it about 5 years ago, and I've had good plums on it for the last 3 years. Last summer, at the end of the season, when all the plums were gone, I noticed they looked like little black leeches on the bottom of all the leaves on the tree. Is that something I need to worry about?
Little black leeches on the leaves. Hmm.
They're about a 16th of an inch long, and each leaf had at least 15 of them on it.
Oh, my.
I've never seen them before. This is the first year I've ever had them, but they were on the entire tree.
Huh.
I don't know that one either.
Living creatures. They were like little worms, sort of.
Yeah, they were just like little, they looked just like a little leech. I plucked one off, and they had a little sucker for a mouth. And
oh, I bet those are the slug sawflies. There are other types. Yeah, I was mentioning the rose slug sawfly, and they do kind of look like a little leech because they have a great big head, and then they chew and
attach themselves
to the plant. And they're kind of slimy, like a leech would be. And I bet that's a slug sawfly. And so, I'm not sure if a dormant oil would be necessary. Probably not. I would watch for them to reappear this year, so really keep an eye on the plant. And as soon as you see them, you'll need to get a recommendation for a pesticide to use for that. And you can contact your county extension office. I don't know offhand what pesticides you use. I know for the rose slug sawfly, I use difenthrin. And I think that's one of the permethrins, the synthetic pyrethroids, and that should work pretty well. And the thing is that if it's a slug sawfly, it eats quite a bit of the leaf tissue, and if you've got them on all the leaves,
it
weakens the plant.
Yeah.
Okay. So keep an eye out for it this year. It's kind of funny that, well, they may have been there and you just didn't notice them until the end of the year.
Yeah.
Yeah, that could be.
Could have been there. And they might not be back next year.
Yeah, that's right. That would have been the second generation, so it's likely that there would be an earlier generation of them. So watch for that.
Mm-hmm.
My orchard, and that's the only tree that had them on it. So.
Yeah. Oh, man. Yeah.
There's a pear slug sawfly, too. That's why I'm thinking it may be the pear slug sawfly that's on plum that can happen.
Yeah. Jake, I thank you very much for calling. I appreciate your call. And Sharon, what a delight. We had a great time. Thank you so much for being with us today. And I'm certainly looking forward to, I hope you'll come back and be with us again.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I'll do it anytime. And I really appreciate all the calls from our listeners and lots of interesting topics.
Lots of great topics. Thanks again. Sharon Morrissey is the UW Extension Consumer Horticulture Agent for Milwaukee County. Does a great job, doesn't she? Really a pleasure to have her around. And certainly, we will have her back. Monday, we'll talk with the author of The Last Days of the Rain Belt. It tells the story of how settlers were lured west by promises of adequate rain and the tragic results. And then we'll talk polar vortex with the weather guys. Stay with us.